Okay, well, let me make sure. Okay, now we're recording. Again, are you? Look at how little his is. Look at that little whippersnapper.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are these microphones?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I need to do the book, because I can't write it all down. You know what I mean? I've tried writing.
Just get one of those little things,
yeah,
Billy.
I need to find out about all that. Okay.
Yeah,
so
isn't
get
that amazing?
This, yes.
Yeah, I can give you the name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're ready to start, and I'm really excited about this, because as you know, last time we talked was really, it was 30 years ago.
Yeah,
and,
really. You were a spring chicken.
Yeah. So to start out, and I don't know, Blaine, you jump in if I, I'll start.
Yeah, you take the lead, and
I'll
come in with some questions.
I'd really love for you to tell me about the Burbank family and the family history, like how you ended up down here in Fernandina Beach.
Well, the Burbank family, the Burbank family, as we speak right now, almost about a smacking gun shooting, is from where we are right now, from the time my grandfather was born, is 120 years. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of where the Burbank name is today. And I now have a son who's 26 years old. Mm-hmm. So we've spent some time of, and this is Billy Burbank, Senior, Junior, the third, and the fourth, William Hunter Burbanks. So my grandfather was born June 5th, in 1893, on Cumberland Island, just north of us where we're at right here in Fernandina Beach, Amelia Island. He married Effie Peterson, beautiful little 4'11" lady from North Carolina, in 1917, and they were married in the old Pennington House, which is on the corner of 6th Street right here in from downtown Fernandina Beach.
Now, was Effie from Fernandina?
No, Effie was from
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
How'd they meet?
They met as her family, her brothers and all, moved down. They were also fishermen.
Oh, okay.
So they were from the coast of North Carolina?
Yeah, they were from the coast, like Hyde Supply, and I think that's where Nanny was from, Hyde Supply, and Englehart, those areas, coastal areas.
Okay.
And that was the Peterson family. They were also fishermen, blue fishermen and all, and that's where most of these fishermen that are coming down are. They were blue fishermen, and then I'll tell you how they started into the shrimping here.
So your grandfather came down to Cumberland Island. He wasn't born.
He was born on Cumberland Island.
So it was your great grandfather who was on Cumberland Island.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
So he would have been there when all those huge mansions were.
Yeah, in fact, he had one. He ran an inn on the north end. We actually owned property on the north end of Cumberland, and they sold it to all the blacks. No, they sold it.
Okay.
They sold it to the black families, some like being Richards that stayed over there. So there's quite a bit of that information about my grandfather's father, George, who drowned. He was a fisherman as well, but drowned in a fishing boat, a little rowboat off Cumberland Island.
And that is so. What was the inn? Do you know what the inn was called?
There is a name for it. I don't know.
Okay.
Right now we need to find, leave a blank in there. We need to
find
it or something, but I do know the end.
But he did come to Cumberland and he fished.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Bluefish?
Yep, bluefish. That was predominant fish to be sold in New York. You know, they like that oily fish for some reason. I love it myself. Okay.
Was he the first family member to come into Florida?
Yeah, he was the first one. He actually was in the Jekyll Island area. That's where he was a blue fisherman, and the Bluefish Run, which I've got it mapped out here how it came, was ended in about 1913.
Oh.
There was a shrimper. There was a fisherman named Billy Corkum from Massachusetts, and he was into fish trawling. He was a blue fisherman as well, but they knew about fish nets that you actually could tow with a boat, like the otter trawl, which eventually came in to be a shrimp net for our coast. That otter trawl mainly was used for fish before ever shrimp.
Huh.
But what Billy Corkum did, my grandfather was part of it, the blue fishermen all came down here off of Cumberland and Fernandina Beach. The bluefish were really thick in 1912. So they stayed, and all of a sudden, 1913 came along, and the bluefish kind of disappeared. It's just a seasonal thing that happens. Still happens today, how fish come and go, you know, seasons. Well, but while they were doing that at the time, they kept catching large white shrimp. Now, shrimp were being caught with cast nets.
Mm-hmm.
But they were catching them offshore. It was mostly inshore, and they were catching them with cast nets all around Jekyll, Cumberland, Fernandina, everywhere. And they would catch enough shrimp, you know, roughly around, just to give you an idea, about 39 to 40,000 pounds with cast nets, hand-thrown nets, little hand-pulled nets to send to New York, which were cheap, and they salted them, pickled them, sold them in the little beer parlors and stuff, you know what I mean, like little hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah.
But so during that time, my grandfather bought a shrimp boat. When the bluefish played out, he also bought a shrimp boat, like in 1913, named it the Playmate. Okay? Now, Billy Corcoran was familiar with trawls from up north. My grandfather was not. He was just a fisherman, so to speak, with gill nets and seines and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was, Corcoran refined this fish trawl net into a shrimp net and could hardly keep his secret because he caught shrimp with it. So they even looked at patenting it from New England area and all, you know, trying to patent it and everything because it was just such a thing that got out of the bag. And they said, oh, you can't do that. This is our design, our net. Well, My grandfather, during those times, started making his own net. It was very crude ways the way they made nets back in those days. They didn't really take the patterns as we know them today because we were taught the proper ways to construct netting mathematically. What they did was just take, let's just say, for example, you and I took a bolt of cloth and we never, or a bolt of netting, which is like a bolt of cloth, and never built a net before, but says somehow or another we got to make this thing into a funnel, a bag shape or something. So we would lay it down and we would take a board and lay on the edge of it and take a knife or a pair of scissors and just kind of cut the edge up. So we would form us a triangular shaped piece of netting.
Okay.
And then we would whip sew it together just by lacing it or whatever, not actually sewing like we do today. And we would put it together. And then we would hang it on rope.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would put it with these doors, which were the big wooden devices that came with the otter trawl design, which was for a powered boat. You actually could row the boat, but it'd take two guys to keep a boat really going enough to keep everything spread and open. But
right.
But that's when power boats came in. So all of this took place. So my grandfather started doing his own designs, okay? And I'm assuming that what happened then is he started getting a little bit wiser as to how to make a net, picking up ideas from other people because everybody was trying to get into the deal at that time. There were a lot of the Salvadorians and Sicilians and you name it were around this area that were some type of fishermen and all of a sudden saw a quick way to make some money too. I can become a fisherman. Well, my grandfather refined these nets. And he made them for himself first for the Playmate.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started working so well, these other people were just, you know, they just didn't know how to make a net and said, I don't have time to make a net. I've got to catch shrimp. So my grandfather had to get his wife, Miss Effie's brother, Bluff Peterson, to run his boat for him because he was so busy making nets. And all of this was in the time of like 1913, 15, 16, mm-hmm. 17, during those times.
Okay.
And then shortly after that, well, he got so wrapped up into making all these nets there was a man, and I'm not sure the spelling on this name, but Maggioni.
It
was from the Thunderbolt area. And he had a fleet of shrimp boats.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked my grandfather, please come up and make my nets for this fleet. So while the family was living at Amelia City then, the Burbank family, Pop and all and his wife and all of his kids were living in Amelia City in
a
home.
Is that house still there?
I think the general area is. I'm not sure what the exact house is.
Uh-huh.
But it was a big house overlooking the water and not far from the old Sandbar restaurant that used to be out there, right in that area. Okay. And so what Pop would do, he would take the family, whoever was born at that time during the early 20s, which was Edith, Lucille, Dorothy, and then, of course, my dad was born in 1927. So those that were born during that time, he would take them with him 6 months out of the year to Thunderbolt and make nets for the Magione. And then he would come back here for 6 months and work, and, you know, with his boat here and make nets in this area.
Where is Thunderbolt?
Thunderbolt, Georgia is probably just a little south of Savannah, I would say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it still there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And there was, we did a lot of nets back in our day in Thunderbolt.
And then they'd come back to Amelia City.
Right. And then they'd come back to Amelia City. And that was about 1929 to 1931. Okay. And around 1932, we'll call him Pop. That's William Burbank Sr. Pop.
Senior. Uh-huh.
And I'll relate to him as Pop most of the time. Bought and opened up a market that he called Bill's Market, right at Center Street Docks. In other words, if back in the day, you could look straight down Center Street, and there was his little wooden shack market-like business there.
Okay.
And here's some interesting news about this building. For some odd years, he was the financier or the accountant for the American Legion. And they had all their meetings in his building right there. They had an old potbelly stove in there.
Uh-huh.
And all the men and all would gather around this old potbelly stove. And so anyway, other than making nets, that's pretty interesting for Pop.
Now, and the market was a fish market, or did he sell everything?
Yeah, he sold hardware.
Oh,
just about anything.
Like a general store market.
He sold chickens, eggs. Farmers would bring, you know, stuff to him, their fresh produce, and
uh-huh.
he would buy it and sell it back. Now, and that was, in 32, and he was the finance officer for American Legion meetings and all right there. And then in the 40s, he moved from that building to another building real close by, almost beside where the Marina restaurant is. You got the railroad tracks running there. So it was right in that particular area.
Where the Salty Pelican is now?
Yeah, somewhere in that area,
yeah.
Right there. And before he moved to that building, I'll tell you a little story about him. There were some of the wives would be downtown, and they knew Pop Bill Sr. would be working in the place, and he could see all the way down Center Street. And they would lose their husbands for some reason or another, and they would try to keep track of them. But they knew to go to Captain Bill and say, "Have you seen my husband?" And he'd always tell them, "Yeah, yours just went into the barbershop." He didn't want to say yours just went into the saloon, but yours went into the barbershop down the road. And so those were the little funny stories that he had there.
And he was known as Captain Bill?
Captain Bill. Mm-hmm.
Billy, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How did the Depression around this time impact?
That's what I'm getting to right coming up right now. In the 40s, he moved to this other building that was close by the building. Now, this marina in that building there now, and I don't know what else was right beside it. But during the time, there was hard times in those early 40s right there. Also, during this particular time, between the 30s and the 40s, they moved and lived on 6th Street, the corner of 6th and Cedar in downtown Fernandina Beach.
Oh.
And they lived in several homes around that area, so my Aunt Dorothy described to me, because she could remember we were always moving. We even moved to 3rd Street one time, is what she said.
Is that because of just finances?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah,
probably
yeah.
Just, you know, finances that we didn't know nothing about. But, again, hard times. But during the hard times, as we found out, my grandfather, for one, was a very giving man. And I see that runs in my family, because my father was exactly the same way. I mean, hardly would think he would be a wealthy man by the time he died in his lifetime, but he wasn't, because he'd give anybody and everybody everything he had. And so I find out my grandfather, during those times, would give chickens, eggs, greens, hardware to different families. And my Aunt Dorothy, who's, like I say, is in her late 80s now, said that He never got a penny from none of them, but it never bothered him because he was still making a living with nets. He had a shrimp boat. So even that he had the income, that's the kind of man he was. He just, big man, big heart.
Great philanthropy.
And
helping the community.
And the fishing industry, what a lot of people don't understand, and I can even remember times of my times in the net business when the economy got really, really, really bad, that the shrimp and industry kept us alive. I mean, we were actually making money. Same as it is today. We're finding a way and a niche to stay alive by using our hands into an industry that's many 2,000s of years old. You think back.
Really? Yeah.
Even in the biblical times, I mean, you can see it even in Ezekiel where the fishermen were lying on a riverbank, and the Lord said the rivers are full of many kind of fishes. Spread your nets. In 1942, they were already living at the beach. They moved into a home on the beach, South Fletcher, about one city block down from what we call Main Beach or Center Street, Atlantic Avenue. And that home was built, so I hear, from some lumber out of an old railroad station from Waycross, Georgia.
Really?
That's what that was. And during that time, instead of making nets in the downtown area, he started making nets underneath his house. This house had kind of like a little basement underneath. It was built on stilts, but the way it was built.
Uh-huh.
And these are some of my younger days. I can remember back in the days the nets were tarred. They used tar to preserve them. And as a young kid, I can remember smelling them. I can remember seeing it on my grandfather's hands. I can remember the white shirts that he always wore and the needles sticking out of his shirt pocket with a little bit of tar fringed around the white edge of it. And I can remember him getting a little piece of rope and chasing me and my cousin Frankie around because we would just be joking and climbing on bales of webbing and rope. And he'd just get after us in a joking way. But having fun with us.
Was it just him making the nets, or was it your dad?
During that time, he had my father's brother, Frank.
Frank.
Now, both of the boys, Bill and Frank, both learned how to make nets during the late 30s and 40s with my grandfather.
Okay.
When the 40s came around, my father, Bill Jr., joined the Navy and was assigned to the battleship USS Tennessee. So he went through Okinawa, Iwo Jima, through the war with Japan. Okay. And during that time, Frank stayed here and worked with the Coast Guard and with my grandfather. Frank signed on with the Coast Guard, did a lot of work in the lighthouse here and rationing. There was a lot of rationing going on during those times. And Frank was... had a knack for getting sugar, and he told some stories about that, but I don't know the whole stories behind it, but I'm sure if I ever write a book, I'll figure out what that was all about, because he told some funny stories about that.
Now, was that also when they were looking out for the U-boats, the German
U-boats?
Yes,
absolutely. That's what that was all about. That's what Frank was doing.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And he was also making nets, which was at the beach. When my father returned from the Navy... in the late 40s there, 44, whenever that was, mm-hmm. after the war, 45. He went to work with a paper mill company. Bowaters, I'm thinking, is the name of the paper company.
Mm-hmm.
Frank stayed on as Pop William Sr., the number one net man. So that was his helper from then on. Occasionally, another guy would pitch in and help, but that's all they really needed for... It was seasonal.
Uh-huh.
Now... When the shrimp nets were not being made, back in the day, since you could drive on the beach, there was no condominiums, there was no people, and I even remember some of those days in my grandfather's old Willis, World War II Willis Jeep. I would ride him down the beach. He'd let me drive with no driver's license, but I'd drive down the beach early in the morning and see nobody. From one end of the island to the other, you'd just see a beautiful sunrise. You would see the turtle crawls. You would see and just see everything like Amelia Island was. Big, tall sand dunes. Had places that called Burbank Bluff, which was one big, tall one down about where the Ritz-Carlton is right now. It'd be a big, tall palm tree on top of this dune. And that was one of my grandfather's favorite places to set their hall saints. That's what they did to make a living during the December, January, February months.
What would they do?
Was a seine. It was a 1,700-foot seine, beach seine, we would call it. And my father and his brother Frank would row this net out into the ocean early in the mornings when it was kind of calm and they could get through the waves, and you'd see the corks dropping out of the back of the boat. And then then all of us, kids and everybody, would wrap these little belt ropes around our waist and wrap it around the net and then pull back up and pull it ashore. My grandfather would be standing out on the outside edge holding the top line up, fussing at all of us. Come on, pull, hurry up, pull, because the fish were starting to go over the top of the net.
What kind of fish?
Mullet, mostly mullet. And to show you and to tell everybody this, we would load the trucks up. They would take them to the fish markets down on Beaver Street in Jacksonville for sometimes 5 cents, sometimes, if you're lucky, 10 cents a pound.
Wow.
For these fish. And all the fish that were not edible, not marketable, they're still kicking, they're still alive. Grandfather always made sure everything's thrown back. We don't leave this beach in any kind of a mess. We leave it exactly the way we saw it when we first came out. So that's one thing the Burbank family learned as we were watching, our grandfather teach us the way to make a living and to survive, really.
Right.
So, And we can just remember being kids. And one time, I'll tell you a story. There was one particular day in December, and Pop says, "Let's go down. I got a feeling we're going to catch some fish. Let's go down and make a quick set on the south end of the island." And I remember my grandmother saying, "Well, you want me to load up the kids and let's come down there?" He said, "No, not today. We're just going to make a quick set. We ain't going to be there long. Quick set. Just go make one set." Pretty much in an area that he felt like there would be some fish to make a little Christmas money.
Okay. And a set would be one big seine full?
Well, a set would be to put the net out.
Oh, okay.
Whether we caught anything or not, that was called the set.
And just one question, was it made like a big box?
It was made like a long rectangle. No bag, no nothing.
Okay.
It was made deeper than the water that we were fishing in so that it bellowed and pocketed itself. It did not gill the fish. Yeah, we had lead
weights. Okay.
Lead weights on the bottom, corks on the top.
Okay.
And so this thing went out and made a big U shape in the ocean, and then when the boat came back in, we'd start pulling from this end and that end, and we'd haul the seine all the way back to the beach. And when it got down and you're forcing all the fish down to the end, some of them will start going over. And that's when my grandfather's trying to hold the net up. Come on, pull. Because the quicker we get it in, the quicker we get the fish in.
Right.
We would catch sharks. You'd catch an array of everything. Jellyfish, starfish, just everything. But hardly any turtles or anything like that. Most of those were not in the area we'd get out. We'd catch a shark sometimes. So that particular day, it was early in the morning, my grandmother, she just said, "I ain't listening to Captain Bill." She said, "Load up, kids, we're going anyway." So she stayed her distance from. She saw them down there. We were all in that old Jeep rattling, the top rattling, and here we go, and little Nanny's driving that Jeep. And they set, and it was such a big, huge set. We really made some good Christmas money at that time. I think it was really $113 or something.
Wow, that was a little... How many pounds would that be?
Well, at that time, I think it was 3 cents. So whatever 3 cents was, times the time. So in all... Wow. For one set, it was good for them, and we had sideboards on pickup trucks. Well, the problem was they didn't have enough truck for the load, so to speak. And so we had a trailer pulling behind the Jeep, too. And he saw us kind of holding back, and he finally waving us over. So here goes Lewis, and he says, "What took you so long to get here?" She said, "See there, I told you. You should have let us come, you know." I remember those days. So anyway, that was just one of those times to remember. And then after we got the net, you know, cleaned out everything off the beach, all the stuff that we were going to sell in the back of the trucks and all, then we would start overhauling the net back into the boat. It would go into the stern of the boat. So my dad and his brother would get underneath the tongue of the boat, big old heavy wooden boat with big old tractor or truck tires on the trailer, and they would just back it up to the net. You wouldn't pull the net to the boat. You would back the boat up and then overhaul it into the boat. Corks on this side, leads on this side, and you would just overhaul it. Put it back in the boat for another set if we were going to make one.
Right.
Then when we got it back to the house, if we didn't make another set, we would put it back on what we call drying racks. We'd wash it out. Then we would sit down and start patching holes because you wouldn't get holes in it. Keep the net ready for the next time.
Oh, yeah.
So that was during those 40 years and all. Then my father, he worked with the paper company. When I was about 5 years old, we moved to Demopolis, Alabama. It's the only time I've ever been away from Fernandina Beach. I was actually born.
So what year would that be?
That would have been in 1956 or something like that. 56.
And so you moved to Demopolis?
Demopolis, Alabama. It was just a little over a year.
Where is that about in Alabama?
Tom Bigby River,
right.
and the Tennessee River came together somewhere in that area there. So I guess it's...
And he was still working for a paper company?
Yeah, he was working for a paper company. And I remember he just didn't like it. He hated it. Of course, us kids, we didn't know what we were doing at that time, but we were really happy to come back to Fernandina. And I remember not being able to get in school that year because you had to be 6 before October the 1st. And I was 6 October 2nd. So I got to stay a whole year out. So, but it worked out great for me, you know. And but I remember when my father was talking to my grandfather, he says, "Is anybody living in the old house behind you?" My pop said, "No, nobody's living there." "Why?" "Have you got any network?" "Yeah, I got some network." "Can I come back home?" He said, "Yeah, you can come back home." So we packed it up and left. And if you want to hear a Chevy Chase story, I could tell you that, but... We drove through some ice and stuff, and we were in an old Ford station wagon, and I guess it was a 50-something station wagon, but my Lord, I can remember we'd stop to go to the bathroom, and us kids were deliberately stepping in frozen ice puddles,
ooh,
breaking through it, getting our shoes wet. You know, Dad just all striked out because of snow and ice on the windows. Nobody could see, and... There were three of us boys then. There wasn't four of us at that time. I think it was three of us. So anyway, and so we made it back home. And so then my dad got into business along with Frank and Pop. So all three of them were making nets in Fernandina, underneath the house at the beach. At the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so then it was during those times. In the 50s, actually it was the 50s let me back up and say one thing. In the 40s, when my dad was off to war and my grandfather moved to the house at the beach, that's when he started making nets for the Hardy family. That's when Hardy and those guys made a handshake agreement. The Hardy family was a marine hardware business.
Oh, that's that big building, the Hardy building, H-A-R-D-Y.
Right.
Hardy family.
That's the old Hyatt, there's a name for that building, and I should know it.
And they were a hardware store, or were they?
Yeah, they were marine hardware.
Okay.
They had a hardware part as well. They branched from just hardware into marine, and the reason they did that because the shrimping industry and everything, all the boat needs around Amelia Island, they needed marine hardware. But in Tampa, that's where the real marine hardware company grew from because of the shipping and everything coming into the Tampa port.
Okay.
All right, so when my father left the mill and came back to work with my grandfather, that was in the 50s.
Okay.
And during that time is when my grandfather gave the business up to my father, not really sold it to him, just, you take the business and go with it.
What happened to Frank?
Frank moved at that time with the Hardy family, because see, we were working for the Hardys at that time, to Tampa.
So he built nets
for the Hardys in Tampa.
Oh.
And that branch of the business was most of the Central, South American, Honduras, Nicaragua, Africa. That was that business. Okay? And during those times, we my father incorporated Burbank Trawlmakers Incorporated in 1957.
1957.
Okay, so that's when my father owned the business himself. William H. Burbank Jr. was owner and president of Burbank Trawlmakers Incorporated, which still is our corporation today.
Uh-huh.
We are doing business as Burbank Sport Nets. We'll continue that story in a minute.
Okay.
All right, as the family business grew during the late 50s and early 60s, this is when, around 9 years old, that I learned how to be a net maker. And each of my brothers, about the same time that they reached the age of nine, they became exposed to the nets and net business.
I wonder what it is about being around 9 years old as opposed to earlier.
I don't really know, but it just seemed like it all, that's when it sparked, and me being older, they wanted to do what I was doing. Of course, my father says if you want any money, you had to work. So back in those days,
yeah,
we all, as kids, we pitched in. Mm-hmm. My mother was working for my father as well as a secretary at that time.
Now, did you have sisters?
No.
Okay.
Just
so
four boys.
So four boys. So they all were making that. But if you had a sister, would she have been also making the nets?
She might not have survived.
But I mean,
yeah, I would say so.
They'd probably, it wasn't you're a girl, you can't make a net.
No. In fact, every one of us boys was named Laura Jane before we were born. Every one of them.
He was really
hoping. And he gave up, you know. And then about 6 gallons of milk later, they said, oh, Lord, what have we done?
Yeah.
So.
Did you start, when you started working on nets, were you mending seine nets first or working on the shrimp nets?
Shrimp nets. The shrimp nets was the predominant. Beach seines were still around. This is what, when my father left the beach house, we moved down to downtown Fernandina. The Hardy family built a building, just a small-scale tin building for our net shop downtown.
So that was the place where I knew where you were. And you moved there in the 60s?
In the 50s.
In 57.
It was, we in the 60s, early 60s, it was expanded upon. Or in the middle 60s, it was expanded upon. Because the business started growing. Mm-hmm. And by the time that I came into the business full-time in 1972... the business just started soaring, okay? And then that's when we went from three employees, four employees, to 12, 15, because the industry in itself really started booming. Boats were increasing. There were plenty of shrimp, and our nets worked better than anybody else's, the same scenario. And also in all the other countries, there was such a demand for shrimp that all these other countries, Mexico included, you know, Nicaragua, mm-hmm. Honduras, shrimp were being discovered more and more places, and fleets were expanding and going everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, back in those days, it only took maybe 1 to 5 years to pay for a shrimp boat for what they cost. They were wooden shrimp boats. Boat builders were just building all they could build. Then, as things progressed through the 70s, came fiberglass. And when fiberglass came along, and Desco right here in St. Augustine started building one of the best St. Augustine trawlers, there was another company, Thompson Trawlers, built fiberglass boats. They really could punch these things out of a mold, and they started selling them to all these South American and African companies, even in the Gulf area, the Persian Gulf area, they would sell. And Caterpillar really did well putting engines in these. And then GM got some take on it, too. But anyway, so during that time, I had all four of my brothers, all three of my brothers, myself, were working with the family in the 70s. And before that, in the 60s, in and out of school, after sports, all of us played some kind of sports and what have you. Mm-hmm. And I played them all. And so we worked just about 7 days a week. And, you know, we never thought nothing about it. We didn't miss the play time because we played in between and after or whatever. But we had no clue what we were doing or why we were doing it. And that's a story that I know my grandfather has no idea what kind of a legacy he's left from just what he did and what he started. He had no clue of the turtle devices and the TEDs that came about in the mid-70s.
That was while you all were working, was when the turtle exclusion device
when it came in, we were the first that they asked to work with the Sea Grant programs in Georgia and in Florida and with NOAA on trying to come up with devices to keep any kind of a trawl device from catching a turtle, incidentally catching a turtle. And those incidental catches did happen, and there are some that do drown, but not all. And again, that's another story about who kills turtles and who doesn't.
Right.
And it's a catch-22 thing, another chapter, another book. But anyway, we developed devices from the mid-70s all the way until now. We're still doing it today. Mm-hmm. We've just designed a new one today that's not really a new design, but we made some changes that the shrimpers tell us now that it's the best money that they ever spent.
Really? That's great.
That works that good on their boat as far as catching the shrimp and releasing unwanted bycatch that's too large to go through an opening of less than 4 inches.
Oh, that's
all the
great.
Way across. So that still shows you that we're still viable.
So how, I mean, have you over the years, when you're designing these things, do you use engineering techniques, or how did you just eyeball it?
It is common sense. It's just a gift, I guess. Some people may have. Everybody that works with this company, even today, mm-hmm. we've been totally blessed. It's just a group of people that all work well together. They understand their trade. Like, we have a welder, Jimmy Cruz, right now is his name.
Who does all the
frames? Does all the baseball frames and all.
Mm-hmm.
All I have to tell him, I don't even have to draw it out, the scale or anything else. Tell him what I want. I give him the okay. I pay for it. He builds a prototype. And here we go. And then we look at it. We actually had these shipped to Panama City and had them towed underneath the water to make sure that we were on track with what we're doing. And the device that we have now is a fixed angle TED. The reason we went with a fixed angle TED is because by law, this TED has to remain on a particular angle of degree to keep a turtle from being trapped. And if it's not on that degree, if it's too far up and a turtle can get pushed against it and held or drowned, then it's against the law. Stiff penalties, $10,000 per penalty.
Wow.
Okay, and fishermen can't afford $10,000 fines at this time. Not with the margin of profits cut to where they are.
Right.
So what I tried to do with this particular TED was make a fixed angle, which they were made before, but we made some changes with the structure of the bars in them so the water flow would be better.
Mm-hmm.
They're stronger, they're light, and they work. The flap on the bottom holds the shrimp in better. So with this fixed angle, there's no way that they can alter it, no way it can really fall out of shape enough to hurt them. So that's one reason why it works good for them. Takes away the, let's not worry about it. You know, it's put in a piece of webbing, and that's the way it is. It's fixed. Here's the angle. It's got some bracing to it.
Okay.
Otherwise, if the webbing stretches, the TED can fall, so then they lose shrimp. If it falls, they lose shrimp. The fishermen like it here because stuff's going through better.
Right.
But if it's on too steep an angle, turtle with his flat back, you can understand.
Yeah.
And the water pressure holding him, he can't get out. But if it's on the right angle, he goes out. So that's the idea of it. So we're still today, even from late 70s, mid 80s, and here it is 2013, trying to protect turtles. And if you can see up on the wall right up here, I forget what year it was, but I got the Environmental Hero Award from NOAA, and that's the time that
that's something I'll need to know too. And just to let you know, I'm going to have to know all the awards and things that you've gotten. So that's the Environmental Hero Award. What year was that?
That was when Gore was in office. What year was that?
Sure.
92 to 2000.
Yeah. So right in there. Yeah.
Could you talk a little about how the Burbank family came to work closely with NOAA? So it's a collaborative relationship to put the TEDs.
Yeah.
To make them work better.
Right. they knew that we were probably one of the most notable and respected net companies around, and knew that we have innovative minds, because at that time, my grandfather and my father had already done their designs in nets. Well, during that time, I came up with a net design called a mongoose. And a lot of people, like anywhere else, try to claim that they did it, or that this was the net that they designed. But
what year was that?
This was in the 70s, mid-70s.
Mid-70s.
Like 74, 75.
Okay.
And there were nets out similar to the net that I designed, but what that net that before this was called a twin trawl. It was a net that was trying to take the place of pulling two nets on one side of the boat and two on the other. Before all this took place, when my grandfather and my father's times were, there was one net on each side. And before that, one net. One single net per boat, then two nets per boat, then four nets per boat, and some of them went to six. But what they did was, and the effectiveness is that the spread ratio increased of how wide they could actually tow, because water pressure in one net can only go so far. You just can't defeat the laws of the pressures and gravities and everything else to open it up any wider than this. The net that I designed was a net to catch shrimp that we knew we were losing them. They were going over the top of the nets, because the nets my grandfather and my father used and built only fished as high as the wooden door, which was about 36 to 40 inches high.
Oh, okay.
The nets that I built went 15 to 20 feet high.
Oh.
And with that came the much increased white shrimp. That's where our predominant white shrimp come from, because they are so wild, so spooky. They kick through the water like a covey of quail getting up. If you're a hunter and you flushed a covey of quail, that's what white shrimp do underneath that water. They just explode. And so they were only catching just a small percentage of what they were going through.
Wow.
So when this took place, the harvest increased, okay? And it also caught a little bit of everything else. So good correlation was Ted's devices in with trawls that could catch more per volume. Well, so during that time, NOAA recognized us as a company that could just about make anything out of nets. And the TED devices, or turtle devices, that we were trying to make at the time were big barriers of netting inside of netting.
Right.
Other pieces of netting inside of netting to funnel turtles out of a trawl. So we worked with all that. But a lot of it just had too many problems and would gill other species and just were not effective. So then we started making hard metal devices. Well, how did that came about? There was... I'm going to give credit to a fellow by the name of the Boone family, Sinky Boone, from Savannah, Georgia area. And
Sinky?
Sinky was his nickname, and forgive me, Hal, Donald, and all the brothers, Boone brothers, that I can't remember right now, but anyway, Sinky Boone, he was a welder, and we had trouble with jelly balls, a big cannonball-looking jellyfish. We still have problems with them today, except the Teds get rid of a lot of them. But so this device that he made was just a metal frame, just rod, put together to put in a net that funneled jelly balls out of the net. Well, all he had to do to make this turtle ready was just make the whole escape holes bigger to let big turtles out of the net. So then there were other... aluminum. These were pretty much made out of steel, galvanized metal and stuff. And then aluminum TEDs came up, turtle devices, newer designs from the Gulf and everywhere. We take no credit for making those designs or anything else. NOAA actually came up with a big cage device, big cage, scared all the fishermen to death. Fishermen were just adamant about, we're not pulling this. This thing will kill somebody on the deck of the boat. Really and truly, it was one of the best TEDs around, because it let the turtle out the top, which is where they want to go anyway, not out the bottom. Didn't lose any shrimp, but it was a big device. And they just succumbed to it. They just didn't want to ripple the water anymore. So, okay, you guys figure something out. So that's when the industry and University of Georgia and Sea Grant programs, not so much Florida's, but Georgia's really, really worked hard on that, and Texas. The Texas Sea Grant program did a tremendous job. A lot of them in Louisiana, Alabama, a lot of places just started working hard on trying to create their devices that worked in their area and what their fishermen liked. So that's how we got started in it. And then as the laws changed in the 80s, all the shrimp countries that were importing shrimp into the United States had to use a TED. If you didn't use a TED, you cannot sell your shrimp. All right. So one, it was good. It kind of held our price and kept us in check a little bit, because during those times, what really hurt us was we started trading with China.
Right.
And, you know, it's just what it is. You know, volumes and volumes and volumes of seafood could be brought in. That's where Red Lobster used to buy all of its stuff locally and from the United States, and then all that changed. So it just started changing everything. So back to this story. How in the world did the Burbanks get into the sport net business? Well, back in the late 70s, when all the regulations started coming, TEDs, there were a lot of boats being built, but you could also see things changing. You could see the economics of boat loans.
Mm-hmm.
They started making boat loans that were like house mortgages, that you could go 15 years, and the interest rates went through the roof. So that really started crashing the shrimping industry as we know it. That kept doctors, lawyers, any other entrepreneur that said, I want to own a shrimp boat myself. I'm going to invest in it, because there's plenty of captains around, plenty of people to do it. There were plenty of shrimp. It's just they could be caught out. You could overcatch this year's production. Then you had to look for other things to do or wait for next year, because Mother Nature mm-hmm. would grow some more shrimp, just like it does acorns, fruit,
right.
vegetables, anything. And it just depended on how many storms, how much rain, as to how many we were going to have, the salinity of the water. Well, anyway, the shrimping industry started changing so dramatically, and then capital gains came about. So they knocked out, they put the capital gains tax on, and just a lot of things kept these people who own shrimp boats from wanting to own a shrimp boat anymore. Boats were sold. People got out of business.
Mm-hmm.
The industry changed to the Gulf more than the East Coast, because there was Vietnamese fleets. There were people from other countries that came in, and the government helped them get into the fishing industry. And so they bought up a lot of these boats, these steel boats, and all these boats that other people were getting out of. And so that's what put pressure in the Gulf area. As far as how much shrimp, there was a lot of shrimp landed, but it was spread out between so many boats, it was hard for a guy to make a living. So that's the economics of what was going on. There are a lot of people that are still in the business today that struggled during these hard times when the economic changes started, but they managed their money well. They still lived within their means. They still do it today. They're still in the business because they do put money back into their business.
Right.
Some people just, you know, would farm the land and just not put anything back, and it doesn't last that way. I told my father back in the late 70s one day, I just said, you know, if we don't, I wouldn't say I was trying to see the future, but I said, if we don't find something else to do, from what I'm seeing, there's starting to be a decline.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the 80s, I said, there's going to be a decline, and we got to find something to do to feed this family, because we were working on labor only. We worked for a Hardy family with just labor only. They furnished all the materials, supplies. They did the building, the accounting.
Uh-huh.
So our family just, we had to reduce a lot of nets. That's what one guy said. Y'all reduce a lot of nets. Yeah. Instead of produce, he said reduce. He came in one day. I said, yeah, we produce a lot of nets. We had to. And so we had to work the hours that we did to support the family that we had and all those employees.
How many employees did
you
have?
It was 12 or 15. And you know, we worked long hours back in those days, and then times changed because rules and regulations of government and government laws, how you work people, overtime, all that changed.
Mm-hmm.
Changed the whole industry of things the way it is. So that even made it tougher for labor guys during those times.
Right.
We had to cut back on our hours on certain guys, but that just put pressure on the guys that didn't care how much they made, like myself. When I look at my income tax thing, well, how much Social Security you paid in for all those years for what I, If I added up the hours that I worked, oh, my Lord. But I don't even look at that stuff. You don't have to put that on the record, but anyway, that's what it was. It just, I didn't care. I just worked. And right. And I've been blessed for doing that. It kept me intact and kept me to where I'm at today. So when I told my father we needed to do something, nothing came about that. I mean, nothing, it wasn't that, hey, we're going to get in the baseball business. This is how it happened. Just one day, standing in the floor, I still remember sewing a net, and one of my ex-football coaches who left Fernandina in the early 70s and became athletic director at Orange Park High School in Jacksonville. And this man respected me like I respected him because I was a quarterback, but I could play like a lineman. I mean, I did everything for him. Uh-huh. He actually got me kicked out of basketball where I couldn't play any more basketball because he said, take a guy out. I didn't know what he meant, take him out of the game. It was just basketball. And unfortunately, I was never let play basketball again. We got in a little scrap underneath the goal, and so that was the end of that. He said, take him out, but he didn't say I meant exactly that way. So anyway, long story short, this man loved who I was for what I would do, work hard, play hard. So he brought his baseball coach in the door, and he just walked up to me with his stern look. Jim Taylor is his name. He's a fish guide, by the way, down in the Lake Okeechobee area right now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, doing really well. But anyway, he said, this is Jack Ryan. He's my baseball coach. Build him a batting cage. And I looked at him and I said, build him a batting cage? He says, yes, build him a batting cage. He showed me a magazine, a picture of like a Jugs batting cage, which was big back in those days. There was a few companies that were huge. There was about five of them that did sporting goods and sporting nets and all back in those days, not us.
Yeah.
So I looked at it and I said, okay. He said, in fact, build him two of them. And I happened to have some orange netting. It was polyethylene at the time, but it worked. So I built him two orange baseball batting cages, which are just like upside down shoe boxes,
right.
You know, just a cage, so they get inside and hit the baseballs. So 2 years later, this same guy, Jack Ryan, we became friends while he was at Orange Park, but he became the head coach at University of Florida. And my father, which you see a picture behind me up here when he was in the Navy, right up there. Mm-hmm. They called him Gator. He's the one standing up. He was
oh, really?
Right now. They called him Gator because that guy lived and died Florida Gators his whole life. I mean, his whole life. And unfortunately, he died in 1996, September, the year the Gators won their first national championship.
Oh.
I remember watching the first football game with him, and then after that, you know, there it went. But anyway, so let me get my train of thought back here.
So Ryan became the head coach of the University
okay, Jack,
of Florida.
And so being that, my father just, we gave everything in the world you could imagine, baseball-wise, net-wise, to the University of Florida. But as it turned out, we were dealing with a fiber called Spectra Dyneema, Kevlar, those fibers that were real strong, bullet-resistant fibers that they used in bullet-resistant vests. Well, we started using them in the shrimp industry because of their superior strength and their fine diameter, like spider webs.
Okay.
So we could reduce the water flow and the water pressure in the net, which meant greater fuel economy. So we reduced the fuel that these guys were burning with shrimp nets. Very expensive material. When it was first made by DuPont and Allied Signals, them, it was about $85 a pound to produce this webbing, but wind up ranging out in the $30-something a pound range. Well, anyway, I got the idea that if it's good enough for that, we need to be able to see through this netting to see the game, because I got tired of looking through chain link fence, big old heavy netting that was used at that time. So we donated a Spectra backstop for the University of Florida at the time. And we donated all the nets, all the field screens. We had a welder building frames for them. So And what we did after that fact, it was just word of mouth. Anybody that came to play them had to have something. Anybody that saw what they had had to have it. So
Wow. Anybody
in the SEC and all these teams and schools that were playing Florida. So that started getting us on the map. And then we created our website. And that was in the early 80s. And back in those days, we had no clue. Everybody says, well, just work at home. Create your website. Get your business. You can do everything else. That's been our only sales force other than just word of mouth
Wow. Till
this date. I still have no salesman on the road to this
Wow. Date.
It's only our computer business. We are fortunate enough. We're doing, you know, in excess of $3 million a year just from our computer with our handful of employees right here.
So, how many employees do you have now?
About 10 or 12. Yeah.
That's what I thought. You have about the same.
Yeah, about
it's just
the same.
That they're different.
Yeah, yeah.
They're doing a different thing.
Uh-huh. And we're still doing shrimp nets as well. We went out a little bit, but we reopened the door. It's just my heritage and who we are, and I finally put back together a crew that could do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so we have a good select few shrimpers that can pay their bills, and everything works good for us, and it works good for them. They get good nets still, and they love Burbank nets. And we're still on the upscale of we're not just sitting still and being complacent with what we have. We're thinking of new ideas. Hunter has created a website along with Eli Rowe that's called Nets for Everything, so that we just grab people's attention that you can throw it in your garden. You can keep deer out of your garden. You can put it up in your garage and store stuff in the top of it. You can, cover your trash truck with it. You can put your child's playpen with netting surrounding it. You can make a hammock. You can, you know, just anything that you can think of with net.
Yeah.
But what that does is lets us sell some of the surplus and byproducts of some of the baseball products that we get, pieces that we have to find a use for. And it works out perfect for that.
Wow.
And we're doing nets for cruise line ships. We have a particular netting that we use for football field goal nets when they're kicking their field goals.
Oh, yeah.
And this netting is kind of what we call a ghost netting. It's just hard to see. It's kind of a grayish color. But it's a strong braided polyethylene. And this netting has been used in some of our larger cruise lines, even up in Sweden. We've sent nets to Sweden to put on some of these cruise ships to keep balls and games that they're doing on the boat from going overboard.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but you have to be able to see through.
Yes.
Have you made any of the nets that you see around trampolines now?
We've done some of that. It's just been because somebody like Nets for Everything says, I'm tired of buying the nets that we buy from the manufacturers just don't last. Can you make us something better? And we just did. We make it out of shrimp netting, which is stronger and does the same job and is better, you know. So we also, just to give you an idea of some nets that are unique, back when President Nixon was in office, you can look at those dates, but before Watergate came out, 3 years running, we made a net for his home in Key Biscayne that was in upwards of 700 foot. It was a sloped, rectangular, sloped toward shore, but a rectangular net that was attached to concrete pillows that would put into the bay area where the family would go and swim. And this was to protect them from whether it be sharks, predators, or somebody, terrorist, or whatever. And every day the SEALs would have to swim it, check the nets, check the area before they would let them go in there. But when Watergate came out, the Navy was pulling the money out of their budget, so we understood. And we had one almost ready, and they canceled it. So we didn't get to build the fourth one.
Yeah,
but anyway, just some interesting facts there.
So right now, I know I was reading that you probably make about 80% of the sports nets now, right?
Yeah,
and it's international, right?
Yeah, and how you would put a number on that? Here's what it is: there's so much of this market still there. We don't touch nowhere near what's there. And that's mainly because we just haven't gotten there yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's other people, they have Salesforce, and there's other people been in business, but anybody that's using our stuff that plays somebody, the other team will buy it if they haven't bought it from us. That's pretty much. You can get on our website and see. We've got every SEC school and ACC schools, and we don't list all the testimonials of all the collegiate schools. If you got in our record files over there, you would just be blown away with the little colleges and little names that nobody even ever hears about that I don't even know about. I looked at it the other day and I said, Lord, how would I tell everybody how much we do at all these schools? But even Harvard, Yale, even, you know, Dartmouth and Lambeth and you know, just a lot of these kind of schools. We do a lot of business for individuals who, once they finish their professional careers in baseball and or coaching careers at high school levels or college levels, open up indoor facilities. Now, that's what Hunter's taken off and been good at. He's sold several here in just the last few weeks that are phenomenally priced. I mean, some as close to $100,000 worth.
Wow.
But they're huge, and they're hitting facilities, training facilities, that they go inside of and teach guys how to play baseball.
Wow.
And Eli, who graduated from University of Florida, who I credit Eli as being the fire force of our business at this point. He didn't know how to spell baseball when he first got here. But just with his patience and listening to me and learning on his own, plus his excellent computer skills. I mean, the kid could almost be an engineer at this point in what he's learned. But he handles all the major jobs at stadiums, stadium contracts. So when these contractors call us and they want to know about poles, pole design, wind loads for poles, netting loads, we have an engineer that we hire who works with us diligently on all these projects. So that's what Eli does. He's project manager, and he really needs a lot of praise and glory for what he's done since, when did he come in? He's been here, I would guess, more than 10 years at this point right now.
Now, is Eli your son?
No, Eli is my brother's son-in-law.
Well, what's
Johnny's son-in-law.
What's his last name?
Eli? Rowe. R-O-W-E. Eli Rowe.
Okay, so he's your nephew-in-law.
Yeah, nephew-in-law. Right.
And then Hunter's your son.
Hunter's my son. Hunter came in here. He graduated, 2008 from University of North Florida in communication and advertising. Same degree Eli had. How that works out, I don't know. But it just works so good with skills. And Hunter's still in the building stage. He's young. And, you know, most business people would say, so here we go, a fourth generation. Now, has he worked like you? Did he come in and do nets and learn nets like you did? No. He did like most of the people are teaching their kids today, go get an education and then get you a job. But here he is, a fourth generation, and kind of unfair in a little ways because he's just kind of escalated in here, but he's given a choice. Do you want to work here or do you want to work somewhere else? And he just says, I would be crazy not to work here. But he's in learning stages still, and has got a lot to put into it, a lot to learn, a lot to go with where Eli's at. That just shows you the expertise of how this thing all comes together. My wife, Lindsay, now. Mm-hmm. Hunter's mom, before Lindsay, was my secretary. She died in 2000.
I remember that.
You remember that? Yeah.
What was her name?
Sherry.
Right, Sherry.
Sherry McQuaig Burbank.
Right.
And we were married for 23 years.
Did she have cancer?
No. Healthy as any human being could possibly be.
Right.
Sitting there talking to her on a Sunday morning. She asked me, you want to go to church or you want to go to breakfast? And I was one of those heathens that went to church in the woods, but she was devout Episcopalian. And she got up to go brush her hair, and that was it. Her
heart attack?
It just stopped. Her heart just stopped, like an arrhythmia. No sign of any arrhythmia before. It just stopped. And they said, it took them 6 months to tell me why she died, and the lady coroner, I remember what she said to me. She just said, we don't have any idea why this woman died other than her heart stopped of an arrhythmia of unknown origin, and it stopped in a place where we couldn't have got her back if we were Johnny on the spot, which they weren't.
Wow.
But anyway.
That was in 2000?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, and because I remember Sherry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Lindsay.
Okay. And here's
working in the office too. Right?
Yeah. Right. No, she wasn't working at that time. Here's Lindsay. Lindsay came into the picture. She was friends with the family. I coached her kids in Little League baseball, and all through. Knew her husband. Her husband's still alive, which was an ex-pro at Temequana. He's a golfer.
Oh.
Lindsay's family is big-time golfers from Johannesburg and South Africa. Mm-hmm. Her father was chairman of the senior tour. He brought all those South African players over here.
Wow.
To play, and finally migrated into the United States. He set up the Americans going to South Africa and the South Africans coming here. He put all that together. He's still big, and he's won all kind of awards and everything. And in fact, he's still tight with Jack Nicklaus and all the guys. You know
yeah,
what I'm
yeah,
talking
yeah.
You know, up to Arnold Palmer and all the
yeah.
guys. In fact, he just sent me a picture of going to get a sign for me with all these guys. But anyway, that was the Henning family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, she moved him when she was 16. She married Michael Wilson. And so anyway, long story short, they had some problems in their marriage. They were married for 14 years and divorced. They got a divorce about the time Sherry died. That was when it was final. I had no clue of this or nothing like that. We just knew each other, seen each other. And so long story short is about a year and a half after that, we were... in business in Jacksonville. And I need to get back to tell you what happened to the business as far as when we parted with Standard Marine, but I'll finish this and you ask the question of how we got in Jacksonville making nets. But anyway, brother just said, hey, Lindsay asked about you and Hunter in church one day. She was over here visiting. She worked 20 ladies in a beauty salon in Ponte Vedra. And so, very good businesswoman, but trying everything she could to survive with three kids on her own and doing it. Okay? So, anyway, so lo and behold, just time went by and I just reached out. We were going to Perry, Georgia to see Hunter's grandparents, Sherry's parents. And I said, call, do you know the Wilson number? Call them. He said, I don't know the number, but I'll get it. Call them. What for? Just call them. They just asked about us to see how they're doing. So anyway, we made that connection. Well, after that connection, one of her friends later down the road got us hooked up. We had a date on New Year's Eve one night. And I haven't been out and done nothing. I hadn't had a date. I was scared to death of nothing. But anyway, long story short, over a period of time, we got together. We fell in love, and we got married in July the 6th. Now, it's been 9 years. This year will be 10 years coming up.
Oh.
July the 6th. But here's the whole thing. She fell in so perfectly to what Sherry was doing and then learning QuickBooks all on her own. Of course, our accountants right now say today they've never seen anybody handle and balance to the spot and to the T QuickBooks like she does. Well, she's in the middle of it right now. We're probably slowing her down because she's... But it is just, tremendous how all of this played together, still family.
Still the family.
And you're still able to work. How can you do it? But we just leave it alone when we go home, whatever. Just, it is what it is. And
I got to ask you one question, though, because so you still employ about 12 people. Mm-hmm. Are there family members of people who were working for you back then, who, like sons who took over from people who were working with you back then? Or
no, but actually... There, I have one of our main four guys, our main cutter on the floor, we call him, our main net guy, Anthony Foster, learned how to make nets through school. Like back in the day, like when I was coming up, we could hire kids from school where they'd go half a day of school and then get a work program.
Uh-huh.
You could pay them less than a minimum wage and with signatures from parents or whatever and teach them a trade.
Uh-huh.
Those are the ones. This whole picture right here behind me. Every one of those guys started that way.
From the high school.
From
here?
The high school, and just brought in and was taught how to do it.
Who taught them? Did you teach?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
We all did. My father was the worst teacher. I can remember him teaching me. And they say I'm not that much better, but I do take the time and show them. And they say I'm still the fastest, but I really feel so much slower when I get out there and sow nests. And you remember how I used to
sow. Oh, yeah, you just sow it. You're not even looking. You
yes,
know, you're just
yes. That's another story of what it takes to be a net maker.
Yeah.
But anyway, so as far as that goes, there's no one really on the floor that came from anybody's father's generation that's working with us. It's all a new trained crew. Sportnet industry is a lot easier to teach somebody how to do it. You're just dealing basically with squares and links.
Right, rather than
and we're dealing with tapers, numbers, fractions, scales of all kinds with shrimp nets. A lot more technical. It's like building an airplane almost, building a shrimp net versus building a bat cage.
Right, right.
But you still have to have guys who know how to do the tapers and the fractions.
So. Yes, still have to have that, especially with the shrimp nets. But we do run into some trapezoids. See, I always laughed at, what in the world am I taking biology for? I mean, not but geometry.
Yeah,
and
now
all this
you're
stuff,
using
and
it.
Even some of that algebra that I did go okay in, but I hated it. But you know, kids, they just wouldn't understand. But now you got to know what trapezoids are and A squared plus B squared equals C squared. You got to know these things to be able to build these pieces to fit in some of these stadiums and all.
Right.
And of course, I don't do so well at that, but I got some smart guys. I just tell them, and they can get on that computer and get any answer I need, you know. So,
I don't know. Before Eli came to work for you, did he have any sort of fishing heritage in his background?
None. He was a snook killer. He caught a lot of snook down in Venice, Florida. That's where he grew up, Venice, Florida. But a great Christian young man, good Christian family. He's got another baby on the way. They have one little grandson now, or my brother has a grandson, Jackson, and one little son. And then my brother Johnny, he is our guy that does all the installs at all these major league stadiums and some of these major jobs that we do. And he travels by truck with one to two employees and goes from job site to job site and installs these nettings and these backstops and all. Very professional and the best. And we tag his work as, what's the best backstop? And it's the one you can't see. Because that netting is so fine, and when you put it up, if you look at pictures, you've seen them online on our website and all, you just can't see them. I mean, so some guys, we've completed the job, and the higher-ups would be out in center field and saying, when are these guys going to get that net up? I mean, this net's got to get up. We're almost through with the job. And they said, the net's been up. No, that net ain't up. And they'd have to walk all the way up there to see that the net was up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So
Johnny likes that when that happens, you know.
And that was, are you the only company that does that kind of invisible
No, net? We still have competition. We have come back strong on that. Standard Marine was not, they were so still in tune with Marine hardware and all that. That was part of our departure in 1999. I was the guy that broke the tradition of the handshake and the Hardy and the Burbank connection.
Okay.
And it came about just in a way of, I knew that we wanted to excel, we wanted to go on with the sports industry, and they were not interested in the insurances and the hassle of everything you got to go through with contracts at stadiums and also having to hire a full-time welder to do the metal work and all the stuff. So there was some stuff, and I was approached by another Hardy member, another family, actually brother to this family, not knowing that I could get into business for myself, really. I didn't really have to have anybody else, but we made an agreement. David Hardy and I, you remember David Hardy and Bill Connors, made an agreement, handshake, we're partners, 50-50, whatever, so let's get into business. But they were in the supply business as well. But they were going out of the shrimp business. They were big, huge in the shrimp industry, but they were more into farming, equipment, tractors. They got into that. So they were trying to wash it out in a sense. And it was good that I was over here trying to sell some of the stuff. They tried to help out, but finally realized, and that's why Bill said, you know, if we ever see that it ain't working out for either one of us, let's just handshake on it and move on. And which is what we did. I finally just said, you know what, you're really just a bank to me, Bill, or whatever, and we're transferring money back and forth and all this stuff. I said, here we go. So we're a young company as far as that goes, like 2004.
2004 is when you went off
when,
on
when
your
the, when we got into the full retail part of sport nets, and that's when it really started going. So that tells you just how young we still are in that aspect of it and how much more we've got to go.
So I'm just curious, gosh, you've done all this between 2004 and today. That's, 9 years. So that's kind of amazing. Where do you see the business going? What would you like it to?
Well, you step in, and I try not. I'm just the kind of guy who I just don't have the mindset to sit down and do a business plan and project that I'm going to be here in 5 years.
Right.
You know, most business people would say that. Most business people would say you made a mistake of hiring your son in the business and he's going to work for somebody else. Well, he did. He worked at a car wash while he was in college, and he played baseball for a year.
Yeah.
He had a very, very nice scholarship with the University of North Florida to play baseball. Played 1 year and finally said, I don't want to play no more. I'm playing for you. I said, okay. So, most dads that raise their kids up playing baseball, especially in this business, would say, dang.
Yeah, I know.
Dang. But you know what? He's a hunter. I named him. His nickname's Hunter, William Hunter Burbank IV. So I made a mistake there, I guess. That's what he loves to do is hunt. So,
there you go.
But anyway, where I see the business going now, I could easily make comments to him, and I've made them to Eli and everybody else. Take it to the next level. Where are we going with it? Well, the steps that I see right now are, first of all, I've read enough books to see that where I'm at now at 61 years old that tell me that as long as you work in your business, you don't own your business. I mean, that's what they're telling me. It's hard for me to accept that because I have been a worker all my life.
Right.
And if I have not struggled, it has been very hard to leave the floor from actually standing there 10 hours, 12 hours a day sewing nets to being more or less a CEO or a president, owner of a company that waits for somebody to ask me a question and hope they ask me a question and then try to guide them and then hope they're listening to me and then take advice from an old guy that I'm not as smart as they are computer-wise, but business-wise, I believe in hard work, integrity, and that if Peggy asked me to build her a net, whoever sees that net at Peggy's house or baseball field, whatever, is going to say, oh, my God, where'd you get that? Here's where you got it, and these guys are the best. So I look for the company staying that way, staying with that integrity, and anybody that we hire has to fall into that place. And I want this company to grow to the point of where I can give back to the employees, so to speak. Because as it grows, I don't want it to be just a company that just still carries the name, still does the business the way it's doing today. I look for it to grow and expand with sales, outside sales. I look for us to take on more jobs like fence companies. For one, fence companies are a big part of our business because we're replacing chain link with netting. So they in turn can buy netting from us and then put it up, so that's a good combination of making more sales. Now there's a lot more of that out there, and there's a lot of avenues to go with these nets. There's not a whole lot more of inventing or what you can do with sports, even though we do come up with new little products, new little gadgets to train and do better, which Hunter's come up with some, Eli's come up with some, my brother Johnny's come up with some ideas. We're always looking to improve on ideas, but we also, if we're competing against you and yours is working good and somebody wants that product, we build it. Then it's not patented. I mean, we're not prideful in the fact that we just want to please you as a customer.
Right.
And we stand by our products. Mm-hmm. We don't just sell it to you and you call back and say, oh, this broke. It did. Here's your another one. And we'll get that fixed. We'll figure out why it broke.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of that. Sometimes you say, that ain't good business. So how are you ever going to get ahead? Well, we're going to get ahead. We're blessed.
Yeah.
And that's the way I look at it.
And do you see, like with the shrimping industry, I know we were talking before about that it might be going back to smaller overhead and the smaller boats, and that would require different kinds of nets.
Yes. Well, here's what's happening in the shrimp industry right now, and this is what confuses a lot of people. For one, hardly anybody really knows and understands that when you look at when shrimping came about, there was already shrimping going on, but like I said, with cast nets and all, way before the 1900s. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were catching shrimp. The shrimp have been here. They have been here forever. But and we just happen to have the right areas for shrimp to produce. That's why you don't see them everywhere. Mm-hmm. Wherever you start seeing the lime rock bottoms, it changes. But this industry, if for example, right now, right away, if there was any kind of embargo or anything against China, Taiwan, Philippines, any of these countries that bring these shrimp into our country,
right?
People are not going to give up eating shrimp. So the demand would be there. We could sell every single one we got. Now, whether they're going to pay the dollar amount that it takes for, because what does it take to catch a pound of shrimp today? By the time you pay for a boat, pay for the fuel, pay for the nets, pay for the equipment, and go out there and search and hunt. You can't see them. You have to trial and error or know where you're going to catch them and hope they're there like they usually are certain times of the year. But by the time they're marketed, you know, if that shrimper is lucky to get a buck a pound out of it, he can make it, but he's got to catch more to do that.
Right.
But the middleman still makes the money. You can buy the shrimp for $6 off the boat, but you can sell it for $14, you
right.
yourself, if you can do that. That's the huge market that the shrimper never gets.
Right.
So he, even when he peddles them off the boat, he rarely goes above a buck a pound. He doesn't go $10, $12, $14. These are good fresh-caught shrimp off the boat. He doesn't do that. But there is a market for shrimp. There's a niche market for shrimp along this coast. They're going to be caught. We actually landed more on the East Coast in 2012 than they did in the Gulf.
Really? Wow.
What it is Mother Nature's, some changes in the Gulf area, where they're dragging the oil. Just a lot of things happened in the Gulf, and some of the Gulf boats came back over here. Well, up and down this coast, the climate's changing. So the white shrimp that we call our predominant shrimp mm-hmm. are getting further and further north again. They're up in the North Carolinas. They hardly ever have them up there. Well, that tells you the water temperatures are changing.
Right.
That changes everything. Fish changes the structures of everything. Mm-hmm. So my point, too, is the shrimping industry dead? Well, to go and buy a large shrimp boat right now today, especially a brand new one like they go rock shrimping with, you can expect to still pay for a brand new one, not a used one, $800 to $1 million for a boat, 100-something foot long steel boat, to go offshore to catch rock shrimp, royal reds. These are species a lot of people don't know about, but they're in the deeper waters. There's restricted areas where they can drag as well, which has kind of hurt a little bit, but another story. Okay, but anyway, what hurts inshore little boats at times is because I can only go with a little boat when the weather's good. Big boats can go when it's kind of nasty.
Right.
So if these shrimp are migratory and they go in and out with the tides, so when the tides are real high, here comes a flux of shrimp and they're out along the coast. Well, I can't get out there because it's still rough. I need to get out there because I need to catch those shrimp. I don't have a license for inside.
Mm-hmm.
So the big boat's not catching any shrimp. So he comes in. He's got big old nets. He just makes a path. So by the time the water gets good and I can get out, I'm not catching as much. So there's my production. It's not as much, but I can still make a living with that if I know what I'm doing. It's like budgeting. Okay?
Right.
Now, there's nothing in the rule book that says Peggy can't go buy her a little 35-foot island hopper boat, find somebody that knows how to rig it up with two, you can pull two little nets inside the 1 mile that's closed to all the other boats. But that's a good place to shrimp. No competition other than little boats. You can still do that in Florida when the waters are open for trawling. They close them from like the 1st of April to the 1st of June to give the shrimp a chance to lay their eggs, spawn. Also gives the turtles a chance a little bit to lay their eggs and do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it opens up, Peggy could go out there and probably make herself $50,000-$60,000 a year catching shrimp. Just bringing them back to the dock. Bringing them back to the dock. I mean, the principles behind it, when somebody teaches you how to do it, you would say, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. If I just don't get seasick, I can do this all day long. You just get your nets overboard. You let the winch out. The winch goes. The water pressure with the boat going ahead spreads the nets. It goes to the bottom. You know how much cable to pay out to make sure your net's on the bottom. And you say, I'm going to make this little tow. It takes me about an hour. I'm only doing about 2.5 knots. So I'll swing through this little slough right down here off come. I'll wave at Billy's over there tarpon fishing. I'll make a little swing around here. He's going to come see me in a minute because he wants some more bait if I happen to have any fish. And I'll swing around, take my nets up. Man, I've got 10 boxes of shrimp. 10 boxes of shrimp. And if you're selling them with the head on, you might sell them for $3 a pound. But that's 3,000 pounds.
Wow.
At $3. You had a good day. That's why shrimping can go on and on and on.
Right.
That's a reality.
Right.
Okay, and so it just depends. So, but you don't have to fish 365 days a year to do more than you can working at a store.
Right.
Okay, so that's why I say you can say it's over. You can say net makers may be going away, whatever. Somebody will figure it all out again, but there's still net makers scattered around. It's just that the generations of the families are not sticking there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's employees learning how to do it, not the families.
Mm-hmm.
So the story of, well, how did you learn it? Well, I learned it from Mr. So-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how a lot of net makers that are out there today got started was through our families,
right.
Through Frank, through my daddy, through his daddy.
Right.
They learned, other people learned how
here.
To, and Billy Corkle, and through me. And that's how it's carried on.
Right.
But what most people don't understand about this trade of fishing and net making is just how simple it really is as far as the tools. When you look at the net making tools and the just the pile of netting that's there and a knife, when you look at those utensils and that's all it takes to get a net ready to go catch shrimp to put on a boat, it's just phenomenal. It's just a part of being that actual net maker. They don't understand. And that's, I'll give you my take on what it's like to do what I did for one day in all those years. That would mean get up 4:00 in the morning, get you a cup of coffee, put on probably the same pair of clothes that you had on yesterday. Don't worry about, you know, what they smell like or nothing else. You might have a little paint or tar or something on your clothes, whatever. You go to the net shop, you look at how many nets you got to build. You start cutting the pattern out by looking at your pattern. Cut all the pieces out, get them ready. You start hand sewing them together after the needles have been loaded and ready to sew. But you move your hands like a prize fighter from the beginning of the fight at 5:00 to the end of the fight, maybe 6:30 in the evening or whatever. You take a break to eat your lunch. You can't be a smoker. You can't be a guy that just dillies around to do what I did all those years
to produce.
And so when you take that, I put in 35 years, say, of on the floor doing that, and close to 100 hours a week. So how many years did I put in on being a net maker? So that's my idea of a master net maker.
Now, and just we want to go back to the tools you use, because I think it's great that there's still so few tools.
Yeah.
But is there a occupational hazard? For instance, do your hands, after a while, do you get like arthritis in your hands or
different,
anything like that?
Different people do. I will say this much.
Uh-huh.
My shoulders have taken the toll more than anything. But also, I was a weightlifter and I played sports. But the repetitive motion, yes, has made some changes. I've had three shoulder operations on my left shoulder. I've had one on my right shoulder, but to this date, being that I've slacked up, if I get down there and sew a little bit, I can feel what it's done over the years. Some employees at times they get what they call the
carpal tunnel,
or you know, just from using your hands and you've got small joints. We had one girl that worked with us for a little while that had happened. That doesn't happen to me now. I may feel a little tingling or a little going to sleep over time now when I do it. But it is a repetitive business, you know, because you are cutting. The baseball is nowhere near what the shrimp net is. It still takes a a unique individual, and you can't be a person who gets bored easily.
Yeah.
If you're that poor person, or if you can't set yourself a goal that I'm going to finish this in a certain time frame keeps you going.
Right.
If you have no time frame, you're just going through the motions, you're just going to be, you're not going to like it.
Yeah.
You're going to go stair crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's because it's almost like standing in the corner while you're doing this work, looking in the corner. But as you well know, when you first interviewed me, I was looking all around as I was sewing.
Oh, yeah, you were doing
everything. I may miss a stair.
You were still sewing, but you didn't look.
but I still, and I can still do it almost blindfolded today.
Uh-huh.
Standing up took a toll on my father. He had both his knees replaced. Uncle Frank, before he passed away, he was at 72 when he died, and he died of cancer. He was one of the Pall Mall smokers. He smoked them cigarettes down to the very end.
Oh,
and I'm saying that's what did it. But anyway, he died of cancer. But his knees bothered him.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of shoulder problems and all, you know. So that for the most part. But I will say this much right now. Today, I'm 61 years old and I'll put it on record. I eat right.
Mm-hmm.
I try to eat right. I eat very little bread, if no bread. No bread whatsoever. I take apple cider vinegar every morning. 2 shots like you were drinking it out of a jug every morning. I have no joint pain whatsoever since I've started this over a year ago. And I just read it in an almanac. Farmer's Almanac. And it says, nature's greatest secret. I said, you got to be kidding. I'm telling you what. Now, for young people like y'all, you would not. You know, really. I mean,
I'm 63.
I'm understanding you lied to me. I know you can't say
no.
That.
No,
you said that before. You can't.
No, I'm older.
No. All right, well, anyway,
but I'll remember that apple cider vinegar.
And most people can't drink it straight like I do. You'd have to mix it with a little water. I've got to where you got to have good vocal cords, I guess. But I would just say this much. I mean, my weight levels have come down. I mean, I'm down 20-something pounds lower than what I have been before.
Wow.
And just that. No exercising whatsoever. I mean, I walk, go places, and whatever, but I've got the same equipment in my garage as everybody else. You walk by it and kick the dust off it, hang something on it, a towel or something.
It's a towel rack.
There's something, other than that, you know.
So, and then with your tools, though, if I was going to make a net, what do I need? Aside from the netting, you got to get the netting.
You need a paring knife, or you can use a pair of scissors. If you're one that's afraid of a sharp knife, or you're afraid you might cut your finger, sharp scissors are used. Now, I call those guys sissies, but, you can use scissors if you'd like.
Uh-huh.
And then you need a shuttle or a net needle, which are various sizes. Some are small for small mesh, little teeny holes for smaller shrimp, and very large for baseball or fish trawl type nets, large netting.
What are they made out of?
They're made out of nylon today. Still, I have a few wooden ones, but, a guy can make one out of anything. You can make one out of a yardstick, a good yardstick. Just cut it off and hollow it out where the tongue area is to stitch your twine on it. Some have no point on them at all. They're still net makers that just make it like if it was out of a herringbone, it would look like an H shape. And you would just wrap the twine in the middle of it, and they just use it to go through and unroll it as they use the twine off of it.
Really?
So, and there's some Japanese and Chinese that just use their fingers still. They use X amount of lengths of cord and just use only their fingers, and then just tie a new piece on as they go,
So your first shuttle was probably given to you from your father?
Yeah, and it was nylon at the time. Nylon was out during that time in the 60s.
Okay,
And
then anything else that you need?
And just the twine itself, appropriate twines. Now, the fibers are pretty much have changed from cotton, the cotton days, to Duracot, which they mixed in different fibers, Nyacot, then nylon came out, and then your polys, your polyesters, and then your HMPDE, the high molecular grade of polyethylene, which is your high density fibers, Dyneema, Spectra, Kevlar, Vetcrad, all of those names.
Wow.
How have the dips changed over the years?
Back in the old day, they used to use, and what they used before that, I really, really don't know. I don't think they used anything before tar. Regular, it almost looks tar. Just like roofing tar. They would have big vats of heated tar. Now, you don't think this wasn't something. I'll just tell you back in the day. This is when we kids started learning this, and then my father and his two sons had to do this. The net had to be built with tarred netting. So they would take the bale of netting, which was machine made, sent to us white, cotton, whatever it was, but you had to have something to make it last, or it wouldn't last long at all. They would run this netting through a vat, which had a roller on one end, and then mm-hmm. and then the roller would squeeze out the excess tar, and they would pile it up, and it's steaming hot. They'd throw a little salt on it, just to the salt would melt and kind of cool the netting as they did it. Okay, then they would load those bales of netting on a truck, take them to the beach where my grandfather was at his house, and then you had to thread needles out of tarred twine. The twine was soaked in the tar. Now, all this is on your hands. You had to have this gojo to keep it from just caking up. So what I was telling you about, tar on your pants, your shoes, string, and stick to your feet. So anyway, during those days, that's you sewed in tar. You breathed it, you sewed it with it. Mm. Now, my grandfather lived 83 years old.
Wow.
So, you know, who says it was a hazard or whatever, but I can remember as kids when we thought we were working and they had a tarred net strung up, we would just walk by it and just grab hold of it, get tar all over us, put handprints. I can remember the little shirts with handprints on them and my mother going ballistic.
Yeah, right.
No, but we're
right.
Working. We're working. We got these little tarred handprints all over everything. So, but when I came into the business, it was still being used that way. And I put up a statement that if you want me to continue working here, we better come up with this system that this guy invented down in Tampa, which was a spinner.
Oh.
So you built the net white. You put the net into this vat that spins. You pump the tar onto it.
Oh.
Let it soak. Pump the tar off. Turn on the spinner like your washing machine.
Uh-huh.
Spin it out. Then use gloves and slicker suits. Pull it out. Take it to where you're going to hang it up. Let it dry.
So it's already made, so you don't have to, like, fool with it while you're...
No, you don't have to put the net together in the tar.
Yeah.
So you can stay clean and white. So when I made that statement, it wasn't, but the next day they started having this guy build us one. And from that day on, no more tar. Now, they got to thank me for that. Now,
there you go.
And that was in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that was in the 70s that came about. So tar, from our standpoint, disappeared. There were still some countries that did it, and we would order netting that was already pre-tarred. It wasn't soupy, messy, but it was stiff, hard to sew. You're talking about hurt your fingers, even though our hands were so calloused up, you could imagine. You might remember mine being a little calloused back in the day. But then after this system came about, then from the Gulf area over here out Texas and Alabama areas, they started with the paint.
Paint.
And this was just a typical varnish-based kind of a house paint. No lead or nothing like that, supposedly, in it. Nothing chemically to hurt you or anything. So we just have vats of paint. And we went from just the standard green. I said, aha. My old clever mind said, we're going to go to Burbank Blue. Burbank Blue sold so many nets. Everybody wanted a blue net, blue net, blue net. Even in sports. But now I've taken away the blue.
Uh-huh.
The reason is because it's just the industry shrunk down. It's too expensive to have a blue tank sitting there waiting on somebody to want a blue net. They would take it if we had it. And even green. So we've predominantly gone to black.
Mm-hmm.
We use this in the sports industry as well. It's an extra UV preservative.
Oh,
that's really what it does. And it stiffens the shrimp net. It's not so much for the UV. The nylon netting itself will last, but it's soft. And shrimps tend to want to kick through the netting if it gets too limp, too soft. When they hit it, they can go through it. The stiff kind of keeps them from going through it. It holds the meshes better.
Okay.
And it just preserves it, makes it last a little longer, and gives it some strength.
So great. So right now, would you say you're doing about how much of your business is the fishing, shrimping, and how much sports?
1% shrimp.
Really?
But it's still not bad for when you look at the shrimp industry. I mean, it's a few hundred thousand dollars worth.
Uh-huh.
You know, of what it would be. So it's not bad. And it kind of fills in some gaps as well as we still progress, you know.
Right, no. And you're still designing. You're
right. Well, another aspect of our business that we added that kept one of my other brothers. Now, he was a net maker as well, Tom Burbank, which is a very valuable brother to me as well. Who ever thought that this guy would be a seamstress? But he's sewing with a sewing machine. He does all of our vinyl work. We make vinyl padding. We make vinyl wall pads. Most of our frames are covered with a vinyl sponge padding to keep the balls from damaging the net and to keep from damaging the ball as well and from ricocheting, so to speak.
So they don't hit them when they hit the frame.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And ball stops, little heavy pieces of canvas tarps that go in the back of the batting cage net so the ball's deadened.
Right.
Doesn't just hit the net.
Huh.
So that's just another aspect of the business, and he stays busy at it, you know?
Yeah. Did he always do that?
No.
He grew into
it. We could call him Betty Crocker. He can cook. He learned that from my mother, but knowing that he was going to, I mean, and he got in there and can understand the sewing machines better than anybody, too. He can fix them. You know what I mean? He knows what happens when one gets bent. He knows if somebody came back there and messed with one of them. You know?
Where are the sewing machines?
Right out here in the back of the shop.
In the back?
Yeah,
okay.
Right back here in that area. It's worth a picture to get just so you can see how it all tied in, you know.
Probably as we leave, if we could just walk around.
We'll walk through
the
and I'll
shop,
point out the areas.
Point out and wink. And,
yeah.
I mean, I know I'm doing what they keep doing. You get this all the time because it's Blaine Wade.
Blaine
and
Wade.
A lot of people say Wade, you know.
Yeah. But Blaine is the...
It's got to be something in the Florida water because it's never happened with the frequency that since I moved here.
Is that right?
Well, I think because there's a lot of Wades down here.
Yeah. Blaine. I just don't remember Blaine.
I wanted to tie a couple of threads together. You've talked about how people who are responsible in the business reinvest.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago after the oil spill, I was doing field work out in the Panhandle on the impact of the oil spill on the seafood industry. And I learned that people are getting BP money. Now, a lot of them reinvested, and they were smart. Did you see your business? I know that obviously the oil spill didn't come over here, but you still sell nets. Did you see your business go up because of BP money?
Not necessarily go up. There was a few people that hadn't bought nets from us for a while bought nets from me. And not really that my nets may be more expensive and all, but it was an opportunity for them to get the Burbank net they wanted, even though they're still having to do business with their regular customers because they repair their nets and all. And they copy our nets. So they knew I would build them exactly the way they wanted them. So, but not enough to be any kind of a dramatic, something dramatic enough that I would notice that, you know, it was a big increase or anything like that. No. And I really don't know what they used all the money for. I will make this statement, though, that during the Persian Gulf War, when all that oil spilt all over that Persian Gulf, I mean, it was thick, crude. That same year, we built the government of Persia 159 trawls, shrimp trawls. And they caught more shrimp than they ever caught.
Wow.
It's just, the thing about the oil is, it's hard to understand because we look at things by what we see and what we hear and what the media says, and oil is a nasty thing. When you see a bird all crumbed up with it and turtles have to come up and breathe through or try to get through it and any kind of sea life that breathes the oxygen, you know, and then, you know, some that are on the bottom, so to speak. There's a lot of creatures that it doesn't affect at all, and oil degrades itself. You know, it kind of disintegrates, or I guess, I don't know the whole name, so it's bacteria, gets bacteria and just goes away. Not saying that you know, it's okay to spill oil everywhere. Makes you understand, well, if we are allowing oil to be drilled where this can happen, and they've got all the money that they're spending now and can spend, Why couldn't they just drill one more well cap right here that if something happened to this one, instead of trying to fix it or repair it immediately, it's damaged, shut it off, close it down, because we were trying to cut and resalvage this particular well versus just crimp it, shut it down, or whatever. Now, I don't know if this needs to be, you know, printed or whatever or told about, but I'm just telling you my insight of what I see and what I've dealt with over these years of the Gulf Oil. And a lot of people take advantage of this kind of thing, and it's not put back into use in a proper way.
Right.
You know
right.
what I'm saying? This is probably off the record.
Right. No, I'm, you know, well.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
is.
Absolutely. But that's interesting. So you were already selling internationally then, the shrimp mm-hmm. trawls back when the mm-hmm. Persian Gulf War happened.
Yeah, we yeah. built nets in Vietnam. We've sent some baseball nets into Dubai, Israel.
Really?
You know, there's baseball just coming everywhere. And, you know, you don't think about these other cities. You know, we think about other countries that I haven't been fortunate enough to visit or go anywhere and haven't really paid enough attention in magazines or what they really look like. But just, you know, in my mindset, I think about Jerusalem and Israel and all. I just think about old ruins. You look at all this Iraq places that we look about, and you don't see these Dubais, and you don't see downtown Israel and the juke joints and everything going on just like it is in any other country, really, just rocking and rolling and everything going on. I've been to El Salvador and Guatemala during the mid-80s, which was pretty rough. I've been down there on shrimp boats teaching them how to shrimp, use the new nets that we developed, the mongooses.
Now, was that through a program with NOAA and
no,
everything?
No, just with Standard Marine, just a customer.
Customers.
Want somebody to come down, show
wow.
us how to do it. I actually built the nets down there because they have importation laws where, like, a tariff. Like, if they bought a net from us, they'd have to pay 80% of what it's worth. You know? So
wow.
it was cheaper for them. We'll just hire you. Come down here. We got netting. You build us the nets we need. Show us how to use them. And we'll pay you in American dollars. So.
Wow.
So,
well, that must have been really
yeah. And we, you know, I stayed with some really, really wealthy people. I mean, that's where you learn what wealth and poor is. There's mm-hmm. no in-between.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, go on missionaries and go everywhere. But when you go down there and actually are in the working force out there, see these shrimpers and the people that work for the shrimpers and the people that have to walk, I don't know how many miles to go work in a coffee bean field and a bean field and just the terrorist stuff that was going on during the time I was there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, machine guns put in your face daily, and you had to be careful, couldn't go out at night much. You know, just different things, and especially hanging with wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, one guy in Guatemala I went to see was under house arrest when I got there. He had his son pick me up at the airport. I was held up in the customs, and I couldn't speak enough English to figure out, what are you holding me for? And all they wanted was one net knife, one hat, Burbank hat, and one T-shirt that I had in my briefcase, I mean my suitcase. One of the customs guys that was head guy just wanted that. And I had enough of them. So once somebody told me, said, oh, you can go if you'll just give that guy that hat, that knife, and that T-shirt. I said, well, give it to him. And then this nut picked me up in this 99 Saab doing 99 miles an hour.
Oh my
we were
God.
Hitting potholes and just about to run over children. I was scared to death, man. I said, gee, my netty. Some stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
These are going to book.
I know.
I don't know how y'all are going to decipher all this.
I had kind of a thought, you know, I'll probably come talk to you again, but 2 hours is really... You know, he really is. You've done great. I mean, but do you have any questions?
Last question that I thought might be interesting to you.
Mm-hmm.
I've been, for my own work, making a lot of calls and talking to some shrimpers down on the river, the St. John's, and was talking to Janie Thomas and Sonny Wiles, and I thought Peggy might like to know that there's a couple of net makers here on Fernandina who learned to get a sense of your impact, who've learned mm-hmm. from you and are now... gone out on their own, Bill Skipper and
Bill
Ricky.
Skipper, Ricky Dudley. Yeah.
Right.
They've gone out. Well, that's good.
Well, it was good if you really know the real story.
Oh,
there's more to it.
A lot more.
Okay. Oh.
A lot more to it.
Probably not for the tape.
Yeah, not for the tape. Not for the tape, but it's. Yeah. But all is well and good. Competition is awesome and great. Bill Skipper does a lot of work for me right on, and I help him.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, he's such a guy. He's so grateful, that guy is. He said, look, he's 80-something years old now. But he says, come get all this stuff from my house when I'm gone. It's all yours, you know. And I said, Bill, I might not want it all, you know. But anyway, that's the kind of guy he is. I mean, he's we help each other readily. Ricky's gone on his own and done his own thing. And he's done well, I mean, what he's done. And just keeps the competition coming. He wants to put the pressure on old Billy. But
where are their net shops?
I haven't met either of them.
One net shop is towards Callahan at a mother's house, kind of out of the way place. Bill Skipper's is at his house as well. Both guys are at their house, and this is like I was saying. A lot of net making has spun off and gone different places, you know, like that. There's even a lot of blacks from Frank's era down in the Tampa area that still do it.
Still do it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of those people in the documentary have passed on, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Singleton, is
all of them. Yeah, just pretty much.
Yeah, and
I'm not even sure about the Herring Brothers or nothing. I've lost track of
them. Well, you know, I tried to find out about the Herring Brothers. I think they're gone because I could not find a phone number for them or anything. I mean, they don't have the where they that was the last boat they made,
right.
I think.
Yeah, right.
And that was a long time ago. You know, that was 1979 or something. So that's too bad. They were really neat people. And Billy's dad passed on, but I'm glad we got it while we got it.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Ricky is probably doing the majority of the work, more than Bill Skipper. Bill Skipper's doing a little bit of work up and down the coast, Carolinas. He does a lot more cast nets for different guys. But he does shrimp nets for a few around, some of the guys that are here.
Uh-huh.
The guys that we do business for is kind of just a select group, and it's enough. You know, and they're very good customers. Ricky, like I said, has the predominant fleet in Mayport. In the Cape and around, and he still does because he's primarily into that. Even though he does touch into baseball, sport nets, from time to time, you know, through different ones. But that's part of the long story.
Well, when I heard it, for me, it spoke to the impact of the Burbanks here.
Yes,
in this part
yes.
of that.
And right, Janie Thomas is real strong about us, and she became a river shrimper, her and her husband, way back when, and. And he's passed away, but she has been a strong advocate of the commercial shrimping industry. She's still today trying to bring on something, even here, trying to bring on a shrimp processing plant and do some changes and make some changes, which is all good. It's all good. And I myself am looking.
She worked for you for a while?
No.
No.
We just made some nets for her back in the day.
Back in the day.
She's just been president of, like, the OFF, the... Organized Fishermen of Florida.
And she's with the Shrimp Producers Association.
Yeah, Shrimp Producers Association, Wild Caught Shrimp. I mean, she's, you know, Miss Janie, bless her heart, can ruffle some feathers somewhere because she's a strong advocate.
She is on the phone for 40 minutes. She was a firecracker.
She's worse than a Burbank. You know how those guys can talk. I don't know. If you meet one of those guys, you'll figure out what I'm talking about.
She told me a great story about the first time her husband took her out shrimping in a 16-footer or an 18-foot boat.
Yeah,
and they
just
pulled the net behind it and got more than they knew what to do with it.
Yeah, couldn't get the net in the boat. Exactly.
She was a lot of energy.
Is she living here in Fernandina?
She lives off the island, but she's in Nassau County.
She's in Nassau County.
And then the family that runs Amelia River Cruises, are they?
That's the McCarthy family.
McCarthy's, and they are shrimpers, too,
They were. They had. His father had been. And they still tell a good story.
Uh-huh.
And this is the story you remember me talking about of what, since you and I had our debut at the
museum.
Uh-huh. I've got people already now that schedule private tours right now.
I was gonna say you could probably.
Yeah.
I think you ought to get in cahoots with the new people who've just bought the trolley. You know, the new people have just bought the trolley service.
Yeah. Well, here's something that has happened since then.
Oh, okay.
When I told you about my friend David Cook,
Yes.
And the property down there.
Yeah.
He has since then, just out of the blue, came and sat down with me. So we're in the process of working something out to stay and establish in the downtown area for both businesses and tourism and all. So we're working on some stuff.
I'll be a tour guide.
Yeah. That's what we need. We just need somebody that loves that and don't have to be long hours, but just because we can't have just walk-ins. We done decided that's way too much.
We just want to
form an LLC, and then we're going to, I showed him how to incorporate that shrimp and how to make a lot of money on shrimp. I said, David, you don't need, he said, I really don't want to go drag shrimp nets in the ocean anymore. And he said, but I want to keep my boat.
So I want to make
a living. So you asked me where we're going from here. Well,
cultural tourism.
This is Billy's mind working out of how to ease the burden of myself out of this company, let them bother me from this company, so to speak. But I got to figure out how to put it all together so that it's the right way for everybody, and then move on and do what I feel like I'm being called to do. I don't know.
Well, you know, it makes so much sense because I've heard so many people say, you know, this is the birthplace of the shrimping industry. It's been so important to the city, and you don't see it downtown. I mean, you just don't see. You might see a boat, but you don't. You can't really.
Do you know what they missed? There's one thing that's been missed. Mm-hmm. The plantation. Before the plantation was built, you know, I had friends that own property down there that had done well during that time, but done really well. Beyond that, but I used to play down there. That's where I had my senior party, I think. But anyway, in the woods down there. But here they missed the boat because people were coming when it just got built, were coming to this island on tours just to see a Mia Island. They stopped by. But when they were introduced downtown and got to come by and look at shrimp net making and all the shrimp boats, and restaurants were selling shrimp then, seafood, they are the ones that bought those condominiums and moved back here. I know a bunch of them that did during that time. And it sparked, where would you live? I would live here. This, and it just boomed. But then it got caught in a pickle like everything else. But how do you get it back? Well, they still prove the point that they can have something. They do the shrimp festival every year.
Right.
It still draws a big crowd. Yeah. So you want tourism or do you not?
Right.
So how do you do it?
Well, and I think, you know, this is my big bugaboo is the what we call now sustainable tourism, which is that you don't want Disney World.
No.
You wouldn't want to have Shrimp World.
No,
you wouldn't
want to
have, like, everything's fake and, you know, it's safe.
It needs to be folklore.
And it's got to be authentic and real, and that means it's not going to be terribly predictable. It's not, you know, some things are going to be dirty and, you know, not cleaned up, as some people might say curse word now and then.
It's going to be what
gonna
it
be
is.
Life.
So it's going to be take what it is.
But I think, you know, it's just like I've had so many people come up to me after we did that thing at the museum saying that was so interesting. I've lived here. You know, they've moved here from somewhere else, and I've lived here 10 years, and I knew nothing about the shrimping industry.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, this is where I think people coming here would really like to meet some real folks, you know.
The people that have taken over our financing, our economic government of Fernandina have no clue.
Oh.
I hate to say that. They're not, most of them are not from around here. Well, I went to the sheriff's inauguration, and there's people in there telling me, are you going to run for mayor? Mayor?
Oh, my God.
I don't even know what a mayor does.
Don't do it.
No, I would not do that. No.
It's like my nephew was asked to run for, he's down in Jacksonville, and he was asked to run for the same seat that Aaron Bean was running for.
Yeah.
And I love my nephew. His name is Wyman Duggan. And his family, the Duggans, originally are from Fernandina. They lived on 6th Street, 5th or 6th. Anyway, he lives in Jacksonville. And he's a Republican lawyer. He's a really, really honest guy. And he said, I'm not going to run. We should probably turn this off because I'm like, okay. Yeah. There we go. Yeah. He said, I'm not going to run if Weinstein's going to run. So he called Weinstein and he said, you know, I'll run, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not crazy. I'm not going to run if you're going to run too. And so Weinstein said, no, I'm not going to run. And sure enough, what happens, but